I said that I neglected to find a joke. And I realized I don't know of any jokes about Emerson. And we were agreeing that Emerson seemed to be rather a dour, typical New Englander of his time. And the best I could come up with is the probably apocryphal one about him visiting Thoreau in jail and wondering what in the world Thoreau was doing there. And Thoreau, in turn, wondering, well, why are you not in here? Feeling that he ought to be more socially responsible, I guess. Well, like many of you, probably, my first experience of Ralph Waldo Emerson was in high school English classes. And there we read some of his poems, some of his essays, and a sermon, the Divinity School Address, which created an enormous stir at the time that it was delivered, an enormous stir in the liberal religious movement in New England. And today that sermon remains one of Unitarian Universalism's three primary documents, along with Theodore Parker's The Transient and the Permanent in Christianity and William Ellery Channing's Unitarian Christianity. One of the really remarkable things about the last piece there, the Channing piece, is that it was, in its time, the largest selling pamphlet that had ever been produced in that period of pamphlets, when pamphleteering was very big in that day. It was the largest selling pamphlet next to Thomas Paine's Common Sense. And I confess at the outset that early on I was not a big Emerson enthusiast. In high school I didn't find Emerson terribly exciting. Even as an undergraduate in college, I didn't find reading Emerson to be one of my favorite experiences. I was more inclined to 20th century writers, I guess. But in recent years, I've been increasingly coming to appreciate Emerson and to realize how strikingly modern he is. Kind of like Blavatsky in that way. When you go back now and you read Blavatsky, more and more as we learn the new physics and so forth, have scientific advances, we discover that that Blavatsky was more and more strikingly modern for her time. There are a couple of major biographies of Emerson that have come out in the last couple of years, and one of them that I'd recommend if you are interested in learning about Emerson's life is Robert D. Richardson Jr.'s book on Emerson called The Mind on Fire, which is now out in a trade paperback. It was published by the University of California Press in 95. Richardson has said that Emerson was misunderstood in his own time, in part because he was so very famous. He gave thousands of lectures that were widely reported in the press, and he became kind of a household name. And when all of your stuff is out there, Richardson said, and everybody knows it very well, it's going to be objected to by some people. There were other factors Richardson talked about, and that was that Emerson, like Thoreau, was an exaggerator. As a result, when he writes on self-reliance, and he's really talking about self-trust, which you need to do anything in the world, not self-sufficiency. He's not talking about self-sufficiency, not about going it alone and cutting off welfare or the stiff upper lip. Richardson says Emerson was misunderstood then and later, was misunderstood as representing a Teddy Roosevelt-style gospel of rugged individualism. This became a code word for social Darwinism, and capitalism ran rampant and was sometimes used to justify every person for himself or herself. Although you will find in reading Emerson that there aren't very many herselves. One of the characteristics of Emerson, more than even a lot of other writers in his period, is that there are a lot of masculine words in his essays, and you have to kind of You have to kind of leap over those. There are so many of them that they become difficult to degenderize when you're giving a talk, I found. At any rate, Richardson makes the point that Emerson's philosophy extolled the virtue of continuing in the face of adverse criticism, but was also very much committed to community, even church community, though he had to separate himself from the church, the institution of the church, precisely because of his commitment to his particular sense of his own mission, or one might say his own dharma. It's interesting to contemplate that, as Richardson observed, Emerson just stunned many of his listeners. He had great charisma, a wonderful smile, an eagle-like glance that pierced through people during lectures and conversations, even though he was also in a way very shy and uncomfortable with large crowds. People had strong opinions about Emerson, and they went both ways. They either loved him or they hated him. There didn't seem to be any kind of in-between, and yet he was always invited back, again and again and again, wherever he lectured. So Emerson was controversial in his own time, and I think the misunderstandings multiplied over the years. I think they've multiplied as we've studied Emerson in English classes in the 20th century. Now, I've come to appreciate Emerson more and more and find myself drawn back to him again and again. And also, I've come to appreciate how deeply he intuited the theosophical worldview. Sometimes I've referred to this in Unitarian churches as Blavatsky's debt to Emerson. Maybe it's Emerson's debt to Vedanta. Emerson certainly drew a great deal from the Vedantic literature. Then, this past year, I encountered a book by a philosopher, Crispin Sartwell, teaches at the University of Alabama. His book is called Obscenity, Anarchy, Reality, which is a great title. Makes you want to rush out and buy it, doesn't it? It's new from State University of New York Press last year. And in there, Sartwell unites Emerson along with Nietzsche and Vaclav Havel and various anarchists and the Oglala Sioux, all in support of a very radical revisioning of philosophical and ethical concerns. It's a wonderful, delightful book, and with a lot of good shocks for the system. Now, Emerson, as I've said, never struck me as a particularly good read when I was younger, but I'm thinking about Rupert Sheldrake and his theory of morphic resonance, and it strikes me that, well, maybe the reason why Emerson seems to be getting easier to understand these days is because Sheldrake's morphic resonance is real. You know the theory, no doubt, that as more individuals within a species learn to do a certain behavior, that behavior becomes easier for future members of that species to learn. Just as today it's easier for kids to learn to ride bicycles than it was when I was a kid. It's my example. Or maybe it wasn't as hard for kids other than myself. At any rate, I figure that if Sheldrake is right, then Emerson, because he had been required reading for so long, is becoming easier to understand. Or perhaps it's because insight in society is just catching up. One of the perennial problems with any thought, I think, is that anything that amounts to real thought tends to be misunderstood when it's first expressed, because it doesn't fit the paradigm of the time and is therefore misread by those who are listening and who are locked into that paradigm. It's not even that they find necessarily that the thought is so upsetting, is that they just don't comprehend it in the way that the new thinker is thinking it. Rather, it's that they simply hear it in another light, and they hear it as confirming what they already take to be the case. Or, as those who hated Emerson thought maybe they did get it. And we're having a genuine difficulty making the shift. I think there also can simply be a misreading when one is in, say, the 20th century and you're looking back at 19th century writers and trying to imagine ourselves back in that 19th century mindset. Under such circumstances, I could imagine Emerson might seem kind of stuffy. It also occurred to me that in my own case, it's a matter of having come to experience rather than to understand Emerson. P.C. Ward, in a paper read to the Chiswick Lodge of the Theosophical Society in 1892, that's Australia, isn't it, or is it New Zealand? Do you know offhand? At the Chiswick Lodge in 1892, he ventured that it is safe to say that there are many persons who would read Emerson with interest and even fascination, who yet would not be drawn to theosophy by a superficial reading of its expositions, little thinking that theosophy and Emerson had anything in common. I've come to regard this 19th century clergyman, poet, essayist as extraordinarily theosophical, and extraordinarily modern in the sense of the new physics, and yet fitting into what has been known at least at a metaphysical level for a very long time. What we're speaking of here is spirit, which is to say reality, that which is changeless and eternal, in contrast with the materialistic, which is fleeting and temporary. And yet it is the material world in all of its fleeting and temporary ways that tends to occupy our lives for the most part. And that's why spirit seems so elusive. I think Emerson had something like this in mind when he said, "Our faith comes in moments. Our vice is habitual. Yet there is a depth in those brief moments which constrains us to ascribe more reality to them than to all other experiences." In other words, we get glimpses of the eternal, but it is the ephemeral that tends to fill our lives. Whenever we recall the religious peak experiences of our lives, what stand out are moments of faith in a sea of the mundane and ordinary. What stand out are typically what might be called flashes of spiritual insight that are burned into our memory forever after. These flashes, which might be called mystical experiences, rarely seem to occur in churches, however. Whenever I've asked people to talk about their religious peak experiences, they've almost invariably remember moments in nature, the forest or by an ocean, in a boat, often when alone, and yet these moments in which they felt another presence more deeply than at any other time, those were the moments that they remembered. And they can be extremely difficult to share with other people when you're talking about them because they have such power in our own memories, and yet when we talk about them, they tend to sound very mundane. For me, lying on a mound of dirt outside my grandparents' farm when it was very much in need of mowing. There was an outdoor cellar that they had dug into the ground, and there was a mound over it. And I'd lie on that mound with the grass way up tall all around me and look up at the clouds floating overhead. And I can remember right now, just reminding myself of it, I can remember one particular time when I was lying there and the feeling that came over me. And it was one of the most powerful mystical experiences of my life. But telling you, it doesn't sound like anything, does it? I suspect you have similar kinds of experiences that you could imagine in your own, that you could come up with in your own memories. This connection between The spiritual experience in nature is certainly something that Emerson and his friend Thoreau both very much understood. Nature, Emerson said, is the symbol of the spirit. A leaf, a sunbeam, a landscape, the ocean, he wrote, share in common perfectness and harmony and beauty. One reason why experiences in nature have such impact has to do, I think, with discovering in those moments something much larger than ourself. We gain a perspective that we don't normally possess when caught up in our everyday activities, when caught up in life's fragmentary material moments, we lose our sense of the whole. The moments in nature that become so profound are moments in which that sense of wholeness becomes all there is, even if it's for only a few moments. The pantheistic idea that all of nature's divine manifestation is the keynote of Emerson's philosophy. The pantheism of theosophy, aspectable nature being the manifestation of one supreme, or Atma. In fact, Emerson's critics among his Unitarian colleagues in the 19th century bristled at his divinity school address for the very reason that they said it was unchristian and verging on pantheism. Not verging, it was. I mean, it certainly was. Theodore Parker, one of the other great 19th century Unitarian clergymen, was proud, however, to associate himself with Emerson and the transcendentalist doctrine of what he called the instinctive intuition of the divine. Emerson began life as a clergyman, as a son of a clergyman. Later, himself attended Harvard and Harvard Divinity School, becoming a Unitarian minister himself. But it only took a few years in the parish ministry for him to conclude that the role was too stifling. He enjoyed writing and he enjoyed preaching well enough, but he had problems with the communion service and some of the other expectations of the clergyman. In his divinity school address, he spoke to a graduating class of ministers at Harvard on unworthy preaching and described one of his own experiences in church. Not when he was in the pulpit, but he was in the pew listening to a preacher who he said tempted him to say that he would go to church no more. A snowstorm was falling around us, Emerson said. The snowstorm was real, the preacher merely spectral. And the eye felt the sad contrast in looking at him, and then out the window behind him into the beautiful meteor of the snow. Nature paled that which was taking place in the church. In his 1841 essay, The Oversoul, which is where I would refer you if you have not read Emerson or read him much, go to The Oversoul and read The Oversoul, and there you will find theosophy through and through. Emerson there intuited a reality much like that described by people today, like in these days by David Bohm and Fritjof Capra in our own time. I believe also this is the same reality that Blavatsky wrote about in The Secret Doctrine nearly 50 years later. Emerson's incredible essay, now more than 150 years old, speaks of a concept of wholeness and participation in the universe that really is extremely inspiring, I think. When he wrote, Emerson announced the shattering of the god of tradition and the god of rhetoric. And when these gods are broken, he said, then may God fire the heart with his presence. It is the doubling of the heart itself, nay, the infinite enlargement of the heart with a power of growth to a new infinity on every side. What a grand conception. And at the end of the passage, Emerson noted that not only does God reside within the human heart, but that there is a communication that flows through all. And this, he said, because the heart in thee is the heart of all. Not a valve, not a wall, not an intersection is there anywhere in nature, but one blood rolls uninterruptedly in endless circulation through all. In a passage lifted right from the Bhagavad Gita, he wrote, "The act of seeing and the thing seen, the seer and the spectacle, the subject and the object are one." A half century later, H.P.B. wrote in The Secret Doctrine about the Oversoul, and there she said, "The Secret Doctrine teaches the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal Oversoul, the latter being itself an aspect of the unknown root in the obligatory pilgrimage for every soul, a spark of the former through the cycle of incarnation or necessity, in accordance with cyclic and karmic law during the whole term." Emerson didn't look to the church for revelations of God. Instead, he looked within. Revelation, he argued, is mediated directly through intuition. "As fast as we can use our own eyes," he wrote, "we quit these parties or unthinking corporations, churches, and join ourselves to God in an unpartaken relation." Emerson had in mind a quest for a wholeness, and this idea is also, of course, found at the core of the theosophical worldview. As stated before, to a certain extent, the theosophical traditions is founded on certain fundamental propositions. First of all, that the universe and all that exists within it are one interrelated and interdependent whole. Second, that every existent being, from atom to galaxy, is rooted in the same universal life-creating reality. This reality is all-pervasive, but it can never be summed up in its parts, since it transcends all its expressions. It reveals itself in the purposeful, ordered, and meaningful processes of nature, as well as in the deepest recesses of the mind and spirit. Third, the recognition of the unique value of every living being expresses itself in reverence for life, compassion for all, sympathy with the need of all individuals to find truth for themselves, and a respect for all religious traditions. The ways in which these ideals become realities in individual life are both the privileged choice and the responsible act of every human being. So there you have the theosophical worldview, and there I believe you also have Emerson's worldview. I would suggest to you that Emerson was a genuine theosopher, to join the ranks of genuine theosophers stretching back through recorded time. Those insightful individuals who knew through intuition that life is not composed of unrelated parts, but is a unified whole within a larger reality that is all-pervasive, but that cannot be summed up in its parts. Emerson was by no means a systematic theologian. His religion was practical, it was primarily ethical. It was made up not of dogma and beliefs, but of an attitude toward life. Indeed, he even had difficulty with the relatively easygoing dogmatists and ritualists of 19th century Unitarianism. The Unitarians of Emerson's day, while radical by the standards of the other Christians of their day, were nevertheless themselves very keen on establishing some kind of dogma. And what was vital to Emerson was not belief systems, but rather how people chose to live their lives, how they experienced themselves in relationship to each other and to the rest of the world. For he said, a person is a bundle of relations, a knot of roots, whose flowers and fruitage is the world. Emerson did not preach fear of God, but rather thought noble things of God. In Emerson's view, God is benevolent and just, decidedly not anthropomorphic. God is known, according to Emerson, through an inborn moral sense. Nor did he deify Jesus. Jesus, Emerson said, made morality personal, gave vitality to ethical precepts, provided a model for living. Jesus possessed special insight and tried to help others to discover the same for themselves. discovering the same for themselves, discovering the same for ourselves is the central message. In fact, although he often spoke of God, Emerson really had very little to say about God, but a lot to say about the order of nature, which he regarded as a reflection of embodiment of the order of spirit, that the visible embodies the invisible. Emerson's philosophy regarded God as immanent in the world. As Crispin Sartwell puts it in his book, in an atmosphere where to call something spiritual or invisible is to praise it, while to call it particular and physical is to denigrate it. The claim that the world itself is spiritual is a way of exalting the real. Emerson, Sartwell contends, was a sort of monotheistic pagan. Listen, for example, to this passage from his essay, Compensation. The world globes itself as a drop of dew, in a drop of dew. So do we put our life into every act. The true doctrine of omnipresence is that God reappears with all his parts in every moss and cobweb. The value of the universe contrives to throw itself into every point. So the essence of Emerson is that we must come to see the truth for ourselves. This also is the essence of theosophy, which offers you no creeds or dogmas, but promotes freedom of belief and openness to the truth wherever it appears. And it appears in various ways in various religious traditions, Hindu, Buddhist, Jewish, Christian, Islamic. In a sense, too, we do not have to simply trust in our own mind and heart to discover the truth. For as Emerson tells us, the world unfolds from the universal mind. The mind is one, he declares, and the best minds who love truth for its own sake think much less of property in truth. They accept it thankfully everywhere and do not label or stamp it with any man's name, for it is theirs long beforehand and from eternity. Emerson's universalistic note is the one that sounds through all Vedic teaching, that truth is not the exclusive property of any one group of people, but the common property of the whole human race, equally open to all who would claim it. Whoever is open to the truth does not care from what source it comes. The truth itself is sufficient, doesn't need to be labeled. There are a number of points in Emerson that are found later in Blavatsky and in the teachings of the modern theosophical movement. The theosophical worldview, with its emphasis on wholeness, interrelatedness, and compassion, is of course present in Emerson. And in the 80s and 90s of this century, it has been evident in many spheres of life, in holistic health, in global ecological theory, in the Gaian concept, and so on. HBB and theosophy have had their impact with people who would never realize their debt to HBB or to Emerson or to Vedanta. Emerson, like HBB, was influenced heavily by Eastern thought. His philosophy is far more in accord, I think, with Eastern than with Western Christian thought. In an essay on Plato, he commented that in all nations there are minds which incline to dwell on the conception of the fundamental unity. This tendency, he said, finds its highest expression in the religious writings of the East and chiefly in the Indian scriptures, in the Vedas, the Bhagavad Gita, and the Vishnu Purana. But it was left, I think, to HBB to truly search out that thought independently and personally. Emerson's knowledge of these ideas, quite widely, though they may have been, largely came from study in books, whereas we are given to understand that HBB's knowledge came from extensive travel and personal contact with the practitioners, if we may call that, of the divine wisdom. In addition to their like inclinations on the broad matters of the theosophical worldview and wholeness, Blavatsky and Emerson also shared more specific understandings, such as concepts of Maya and karma. In Emerson's time, Westerners had little contact with Eastern thought, but in his own study, Emerson developed a strong affinity with Hindu and Buddhist thought. Karma appears in Emerson in the law of compensation, the law of balance, the law of action and reaction, Blavatsky's law of cause and effect. Maya in Emerson is described in terms of form and appearance. Emerson wrote of real nature and apparent nature, the world having an illusionary nature, he said. He wrote, "We stand before the secret of the world, there where being passes into appearance and unity into variety." The same idea, of course, is found in Blavatsky's secret doctrine. The one being is the noumenon of all the noumena, which we know must underlie phenomena and give them whatever shadow of reality they possess, but which we have not the senses or the intellect to cognize at present. Emerson's secret of the world is HPB's Isis, I think, awaiting, shall we say, to be unveiled. Blavatsky wrote of how the mind produces the apparent universe. The universal process, she said, is the only universal and eternal reality, casting a periodical reflection of itself on the infinite spatial depths. This reflection, which you regard as the objective material universe, we consider as a temporary illusion and nothing else. The doctrine of compensation, Emerson said, means that there is one event to good and evil. If I gain any good, I must pay for it. If I lose any good, I gain some other. All actions are indifferent. And in the same essay, he wrote that life invests itself with inevitable conditions. He described how the entire system gets represented in every particle, which is surely theosophical and is, as well, very much central to modern holographic theory. HPB's picture of the universe as a boundless plane within which innumerable particular universes blink on and off like lights in accordance with laws of periodicity is suggestive of current cosmology, the Big Bang theory of expansion and contraction of universes, as the 19th century secret doctrine is suggestive of current holographic views of consciousness. HPB wrote, "Nothing is permanent except the one hidden absolute existence which contains in itself the noumena of all realities, the existences belonging to every plane of being up to the highest Dian Choans, are comparatively like the shadow cast by a magic lantern on a colorless screen. Nevertheless, all things are relatively real, for the cognizer is also a reflection, and the things cognized are therefore as real to him as himself." Yet another area in which there is considerable similarity between Emerson and Blavatsky is that of a belief in masters, Mahatmas, or great souls. According to Blavatsky in her Theosophical Glossary, there have at all times been individuals who have had knowledge of these advanced souls, who, having attained to the mastery over their lower principles, are thus living unimpeded by the man of flesh and are in possession of knowledge and power commensurate with the stage they have reached in their spiritual evolution. I think Emerson, too, believed in great souls. What he referred to as those rare pilgrims whereof only one or two wander in nature at once, and before whom the vulgar show as specters and shadows. He believed that these rare pilgrims had a knowledge of all natural laws, and he said, "By being assimilated to the original soul, by whom and after whom all things subsist, the soul of man does then easily flow into all things, and all things flow into it. They mix, and he is present and sympathetic with their structure and law." Emerson is then one of those who I think made the modern theosophical movement possible by preparing minds for the teaching to be set forth. He sensed vast changes coming, and in 1844 he wrote that in liberated moments we know that a new picture of life and duty is already possible. The elements already exist in many minds around you of a doctrine of life which shall transcend any written record we have. We might well say something like that today, for we are surely in a time of great ferment and change. Such times are perhaps more confusing than earlier times, but the task remains always the same, to seek to live with divine unity. And the Oversoul is that unity, that great nature in which we rest as the earth lies in the soft arms of the atmosphere. HPB tells us that it is the soul which interpenetrates and informs all things, a radiation of the ever-unknown universal absolute. Our own egos are identical with it. Finally, I want to just conclude with two passages from Emerson. Both of these come from the Oversoul, where Emerson wrote, "Ineffable is the union of man and God in every act of the soul. The simplest person who in his integrity worships God becomes God. Yet forever and ever the influx of this better and universal self is new and unsearchable. It inspires awe and astonishment. How dear, how soothing to man arises the idea of God peopling the lonely place, effacing scars of our mistakes and disappointments. When we have broken our God of tradition and ceased from our God of rhetoric, then may God fire the heart with his presence. It is the doubling of the heart itself, nay, the infinite enlargement of the heart, with a power of growth to a new infinity on every side. It inspires in us an infallible trust." And then, "The soul calls the light its own and feels that the grass grows and the stone falls by a law inferior to and dependent on its nature. Behold, it saith, I am born into the great, the universal mind. I, the imperfect, adore my own perfect. I am somehow receptive of the great soul, and thereby I do overlook the sun and the stars, and feel them to be the fair accidents and effects which change and pass. More and more the surges of everlasting nature enter into me, and I become public and human in my regards and actions. So come I to live in thoughts and act with energies which are immortal. Thus revering the soul and learning, as the ancient said, that its beauty is immense, man will come to see that the world is the perennial miracle which the soul worketh, and be less astonished at particular wonders. He will learn that there is no profane history, that all history is sacred, that the universe is represented in an atom, in a moment of time. He will weave no longer a spotted life of shreds and patches, but he will live with a divine unity."